My name is Guy Siner, and the character I played is Lieutenant Gruber. David Croft called me in to an interview, and I read for the part. It was one of the few occasions, in fact, I think almost probably the only occasion in a very long career that I walked out of the room with the job. It was very nice. The last thing he said to me was, "Well, it's yours if you want it." I said, "Okay, that'll be fine, thank you." Of course, who knew then how long it was going to last and what a wonderful job it was going to be. This was just an audition for the pilot. About the locations, yes, well, the locations were for they were all in Norfolk, and for the most part in North Norfolk. We were usually based in a town called Swaffham, and we filmed in and around that area. Of course, the chateau was Linford Hall, which is now a posh hotel and restaurant, but then it was considerably less posh and hadn't yet been developed to the extent it has now. And so we filmed in the house and in the lovely grounds and in the sort of countryside around and about the lanes and fields and so on in the vicinity. And then they also did some filming in Cromer, which is on the coast, the north coast of Norfolk, where they did sort of beach scenes and submarine landings and sending the airmen away in rowing boats with crabs in them, that kind of thing. So yes, we're all over that area. David Croft always told us that it was because it was Norfolk is so flat, and it was very good casting, as it were, as a location for northern France. But of course, he was lying in his teeth. It was because he lived down the road, and it took him about 5 minutes to get to work, whereas the rest of us had to stay in a location hotel, you know, for weeks on end. Bless his heart. That would have been Gordon Kaye as René, because it was quickly established that we would have these set piece scenes between him and me at the bar, usually involving misunderstandings. Me thinking I was being invited, you know, into his back room for nefarious purposes, and him meaning something quite other, you know, or, you know, a resistance radio hidden under the bar making strange noises and me misunderstanding what it was saying, that kind of thing. As I say, it became a sort of set piece, and the audience just loved them. And so they wrote more and more of them, and they were huge fun to play, of course, between him and me. Yes, indeed. Richard as the old colonel and Sam as the captain. We had, yes, quite a lot of scenes together, you know, in the colonel's office, which was always great fun and unpredictable, given that Richard Marner was the other actor. You never knew what line was going to come out. It might have been something from the week before last. He was a wonderful man and wonderfully unreliable with his lines. After Sam left, they replaced his character with the Italian. And yes, there were indeed two of them. There was Gavin Richards, and he left after a while and was replaced. It was just one of those things, you know. People moved on to do other things, or you know, wanted to do other work or whatever. So we lost the odd person along the way. I must say it was a great sadness to me personally to lose Sam Kelly, because I thought he was absolutely wonderful as Captain Gearing. It was a wonderful experience, the whole 10 years. It was a wonderful cast. It really was. I mean, David Croft was sort of famous for this. He used to say, you know, I don't cast stars, I make them. And he sort of did. I mean, we weren't stars, of course. We were household names, I suppose, but the show was the star. But David was incredibly clever at casting, and there were some marvelous performances in the show, as well as, of course, as it being quite beautifully written. David Croft and Jeremy Lloyd were two of the best comedy writers I think England has ever seen, and with some really clever casting, it was a wonderful experience to work on. And indeed, it's still. I don't enjoy watching my own work, but when I occasionally catch an episode on the television, I still think how wonderful it is, and I so enjoy watching my friends work. It still gives me enormous pleasure when I occasionally see an episode. Roger Kitter was the one who took over from Gavin Richards, yes, as the Italian. People ask me, you know, did anything funny ever happen, you know, while you were working on the show? And my answer is always the same, and that is, yes, the shows. or as Richard Gibson always says, comedy is a serious business. And indeed it is. And although we had huge fun making it, of course, you know, one always has one ear on the audience and you know, you're timing the jokes and so on. So it's great fun, and I know it looked great fun. Everybody always remarks on that, but at the same time, it was work. It was our job. It was extremely hard work sometimes, and it was very important that we got it right as often as possible. So it was a huge pleasure working, as I say, with everybody, and I suppose in particular with Gordon, because it was him I worked with most. Many of the others also, you know, it was wonderful to work with people. When people ask me about my favorite scene, there are so many, but I always end up mentioning Kenneth Connor and the interrogation of Monsieur Alphonse, which is, I think, one of the best scenes in the show, and it's very often repeated in interviews and, you know, television shows all over the world. They've shown that scene over and over and over, because it really is truly very funny. Kenneth Connor was a superb comedian. He really was. He was the most consummate actor. Of course, it was a joy to be working with the two of them. I mean, as I said earlier, two of the best comedy writers we've ever produced. And David also, a wonderful director and producer. He just had the most marvelous feel for the half hour comedy series, for that format. He just handled it absolutely beautifully, both in the writing and in the direction, casting and so on. So one felt incredibly privileged to work with him, but also incredibly safe in his hands, if you know what I mean. He knew, we would sit down on a Monday morning and do the read through and fall about at each other's lines and, you know, at the jokes and so on. And then we would start work. And you just knew that by the time the crew came in to watch you on a Friday, you know, when they were setting up cameras and so on, you just knew by then that the reaction was going to be wonderful. And you knew, of course, that when you got in front of an audience, it was going to work, because David knew exactly how to pace it and how to get the best out of the actors. And he had a wonderful crew. You know, we had the marvelous Ken Major, who was the you know, our chief cameraman, camera operator, and Angela Beveridge, who was the best vision mixer ever, who you know, we relied on completely for our timing, because she would cut between cameras, and you know, a vision mixer can kill your performance just as she or he can make it. So you know, all of these people contributed, and again, it was, you know, part of David's genius that he surrounded himself with the best people. I remember it's interesting you mentioned Mike McCarthy, because I remember sitting in the cipher room with him. I can't remember why he had allowed me into his inner sanctum, but he did. And he was editing whatever episode we had shot the previous week. And I watched him at work. And the fascinating thing was that he said to me, you know, this is where we pump up the audience reaction, you know, to make it bigger it's what they call sweetening. But he said, the exception is your show, he said, because with your show, I have to fight to keep the sound that the audience was making down, because otherwise we can't hear the dialogue, because the audience are laughing so much. So it was a great compliment, really. But I mean, I actually saw this, you know, for real. You know, the microphones would catch a different set of microphones and recorders would catch the audience, and he would literally have to halve the level of the audience in order for the show to be heard, because the reaction had been so enormous. It was really extraordinary. Again, lucky us. It was, the writing, you know, was just so wonderful that it was an absolute joy for the audience to see and listen to. It was a live audience, and so Mike McCarthy, as I say, would have to try desperately to balance the sound that live audience was making, so that there was something they could broadcast, because otherwise the viewing audience on the television wouldn't have been able to hear the show. So much noise was the audience making. It was David's policy, and I think quite rightly, that we would shoot the show as much as possible as live. Because, as you quite rightly say, you can only expect a live audience who are seeing the show for the first time to react to the same joke, you know, one or two times. They're not going to go on giving you a good reaction if you're shooting it three or four times because you're being lazy about the lines or the cameras are, you know, missing their cues or whatever. So this is, goes back to what I was saying about comedy being a serious business. It was a part of our job, both the actors and the crew, to know what they were doing and to get it right first time as much as possible, for that reason, so the audience weren't forced to watch it again and again. Obviously, there were times when, you know, something would go wrong, whatever it might be. An actor might stumble over a line, or a camera might stumble over a cable, or something would necessitate us doing it again. And even as I said before, the audience would be making so much noise that we couldn't go on, as it were, and so we would have to stop recording even on one occasion. The pilot episode, funnily enough, the famous matches scene between Gruber and René at the bar. And at the end of that scene, they had to stop recording because the audience were continuing to react. They were continuing to laugh and applaud for so long that David had to cut the recording. And that was an extremely expensive business, cutting recording, because all the machines were down in Lime Grove, and the whole thing was coming over a very expensive telephone line, and it was a serious business, recording live to tape. It was an expensive undertaking, and when you had to cut and start all the machines again, that cost money, and so it was only very rarely done, and it, only when we, for want of a better way of putting it, we had earned the right to cut the recording, if you see what I mean. As I say, the audience wouldn't, until Gordon and I had sort of taken a bow, as it were, and asked the audience to please quieten down so we could carry on. Only then could David start recording again. That, as I say, only for, as far as I know, happened on that one occasion, but there were many occasions where the audience reaction was so large that at the end of a scene, we would have to re-record maybe a couple of lines or a little section or something in order that the joke would get across. Otherwise, the television audience wouldn't have seen it, or wouldn't have heard it, rather. Yes, as I say, other than that, you know, little mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, of course, and you know, actors would occasionally dry, or as I say, you know, the crew would, something would go wrong with the cameras or the sound, or you know, a boom would come into shot, or you know, any number of things can go wrong when you're recording a show in front of a live audience. And on those occasions, we would just do what we call a pickup, either at the end of the scene or possibly at the end of the show. When the whole show had finished recording, there would be maybe a few shots that we had to pick up. In other words, do again. But as I say, it was David's policy not to do that. So the sort of default position for the show from beginning to end, and then say goodnight to the audience, and that would be what would be broadcast. Well, I can't remember when it first appeared, but of course, you know, Lieutenant Gruber was right from the beginning. He was a tank officer. You know, he was dressed in a Panzer uniform, the pink braiding, and the medals. You know, the which showed that he'd been through tank battles. So he was a tank officer, a Panzer officer. And when we actually saw the tank for the first time, it's an interesting question. I can't remember what episode it first appeared in, but it was and is really a bigger star than I am. I get more fan mail for the tank than I do for myself. It was so popular. It was a wonderfully clever idea, the little tank. It became a character. And a very funny character. I only drove it for fun when allowed, and never on camera, of course, because you can't see the driver. The driver is deep inside the little tank, and only he can't see. Never mind, you can't see him. There are only little tiny slits for him to look through. And I stood, as you know, on the sort of up in the turret so that you could see me. Otherwise, there would be no point in me trying to act. And I, in fact, was usually standing on the back of the driver's seat, a way for me to stand. He had a sort of metal chair that was bolted to the floor. And then he was down there driving the tank. And the driver, Clarence, who again was a character, although never seen, of course, but you know, you imagined this beautiful boy with long blonde hair who was a close friend of Lieutenant Gruber. But actually it was the son of the owner of the museum from which the tank came. And his name's Peter, and he still, now his father died sadly some years ago, and he now owns and runs the museum where the little tank belongs, which is you know, the Museum of Ancient Vehicles. So yes, that Clarence is still about, and the little tank is still about, and occasionally I go and visit it, which is lovely. It's the museum is in Eton Wick, near Windsor. And that's reasonably close to me. I live in Buckinghamshire, so I'm only, you know, half an hour away. And yes, I went and saw it and they took pictures of me in the turret of the tank, and it was, we worked out that it was sort of, I don't know, 30 years or something since I had last been in the tank, and it was a lovely moment. Actually made me cry. Yes, there was supposed to be there was the episode when it's supposed to have been blown to bits by with a bomb by the Italian captain, and then it was replaced with the little tank was replaced with a big tank, but actually it was always the same tank that came back in the following episode. And wasn't a tank at all, of course. It's what they call an armored reconnaissance vehicle, a 222. But it was, yes, it was always the same one. And we just sort of moved on to the next time the little tank appeared. It was the same little tank. It would have been too much to try and introduce the audience to another vehicle that looked different and so on. So they would just use the same one. We did a nationwide tour for, I can't remember, for sort of 15 weeks or something, all around the country, broke box office records in every theater we played. And then we came into the Prince of Wales for a year. And yes, of course I remember. My picture was outside the front of the Prince of Wales, sort of, I don't know, six times life size, right outside the front of the theatre with René on one side and me on the other of the door. And then we closed there because there was another production that was contracted to come into the theatre. And so we were sort of chucked out. And even though we were still playing to full houses, and we transferred to the Palladium. And that was an extraordinary experience, playing the London Palladium. I think they've still, you know, our picture is up on the wall there because it was one of the most successful shows they've ever had. We had the firemen waived all the rules you could in those days. It was a different world. And we had, when we opened, we had something like 100 people, I believe, standing at the back of the stalls. Because it was sold out for months and months in advance. And it was, yes, it was huge. And it was an extraordinary experience. It really was, to have the reaction. You know, we were used to the reaction of the studio audience, but of course, you know, that was 200, 250 people. The Palladium seats, I don't know, 2,800 or something. And it was a wall of sound from the audience. It was breathtaking. It was breathtaking. It was a wonderful experience, yes. Something I shall treasure all my life. Well, the whole thing is a wonderful experience and a wonderful memory. And lucky me to have been involved in it. Well, thank you very much for giving me the time. And I'm always glad to talk about the show.